coming up on Path to Zero.
The current system is broken. In the end, it takes longer to get a federal permit in this country than it takes an 18-year-old to get a college degree.
Welcome to Path to Zero, the podcast about clean energy and the journey toward a low-carbon future. Your host is Tucker Perkins, President and CEO of the Propane Education and Research Council. Now, here's Tucker.
Hello, and welcome to Path to Zero. As the conversation around energy continues to evolve in Washington and beyond, a big part of the focus is on how policy can actually support innovation. Our guest in this episode is right in the middle of that conversation, as the CEO of ClearPath, Jeremy Harrell, is at the forefront of the conservative clean energy movement. ClearPath is helping shape a more pragmatic, bipartisan approach to clean energy solutions. Jeremy, we're so looking forward to this conversation on our special edition of Path to Zero, Sarah Week. So thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
We could talk about a lot of things, but let's just start by talking about ClearPath, maybe what you do, what ClearPath does, and maybe eventually talk to us about how you define conservative issues and how you think about clean energy. It's a very broad term.
Yeah, ClearPath's a unique organization. So we're a conservative clean energy advocacy organization, and our mission is to accelerate American innovations to reduce global energy emissions. And we work across the power sector, heavy industry, and agriculture sector. So how do we catalyze and drive forward new technologies like advanced nuclear, geothermal, long-duration energy storage, as well as building blocks of the global economy like cement, steel, fertilizer, in an affordable and lower emissions way? And we come at this kind of uniquely from the conservative perspective. So a focus on innovation rather than regulations, and markets over mandates. And so how do we empower private sector investment into these technologies from the early stages, research and development, all the way to the U.S. exporting these technologies and impacting the global picture?
And great. So I take it that people who are members and constituents, I guess, for lack of a better word, they can be all of those things. They can be providers, they can be users, industry, utilities. And then at the end of the day, once you kind of reach a strategic plan, you're working to get your ideas through Congress, get some funding, maybe clear the way, right?
So we're unique. We don't have members, but we operate like a business. Right. So we look for barriers to private sector development, how federal policy or in some cases state policy are getting in the way or unnecessarily slowing things down. And we tackle those in a collaborative way. So we're philanthropic funded, so no members, we're not a trade association, but we have all the tools in the advocacy tool belt. So like a think tank, major data research analysis, we combine that with message testing and polling. So when we work with policymakers, we tell them how to talk about it in DC as well as back at home. We build bipartisan coalitions with industry partners, with tech startups and traditional companies, and other NGOs, even labor in some cases. And then ultimately, we lobby and advocate to get it across the finish line. So it's really a soup to nuts policy approach.
Yeah, excellent. And so today, it's kind of big picture. Where do you see some of the technologies, I mean, not just energies, but also technologies that are particularly promising as you look over the next, I don't know, 3 to 5 maybe?
Yeah. We're in an incredible moment in this country. After more than 2 decades of effectively stagnant demand, this drive, this increased electricity demand being pushed by AI, data centers, a focus on onshoring more American manufacturing, and general electrification of the economy is changing the paradigm. We're seeing investors' risk appetite change dramatically because they know we need more electrons. And so technologies like nuclear, like enhanced geothermal, even fusion, are getting more and more attention. And I think we're in this unique moment where we're in deployment land, and we're going to see this new American technologies really take off and be leading technology offerings for the globe.
You leave out solar and wind, which has kind of been a real hot topic, particularly in D.C., particularly as we segregate wind into onshore, offshore.
Mm-hmm.
You got strong views on the future of solar, wind, both on and offshore?
We support an all-of-the-above energy strategy. In the end, we think this country needs every electron that we can put on the grid. But our innovation focus means we're trying to catalyze early-stage technologies. So solar and wind, significant part of the grid already today. There are things to be done in innovation, but not as much as how do we drive down the cost of advanced nuclear reactors? How do we tackle some of these material challenges to ensure that we can do deep drilling wells of geothermal and tap the resource more? And so we think we need every electron, and we want to put all the tools and empower the private sector to deploy those technologies quickly.
One technology I saw you had been particularly supportive of, you were big about the hydrogen hubs. Kind of really the bloom has really fallen off the rose mm-hmm. for hydrogen. Do you have a differing viewpoint from that today than perhaps you did 3 or 4 years ago?
We do. I think hydrogen has a future as a feedstock, particularly in heavy industry. I think that there, about 4 years ago, when the major investments from the infrastructure bill got put into place, the robust tax credit from the IRA, which has now been scaled back, we had like a bigger, broader view of how it potentially could move forward. But cost is the key here, right? And it's hard to see some segments of the hydrogen sector getting to a cost point that we could see it taking it off. But really promising opportunities in things like geologic hydrogen, in what people call blue hydrogen. I don't like the color codes, but lower emission hydrogen production. And I think they're going to be critical for manufacturing, not only here in the U.S., but globally as well.
And you talk a lot, I've studied a bit, you talk a lot about low-carbon fuels like, I would say, propane and natural gas. So you see them a part of the mix going forward for sure?
Absolutely. We see gas in an essential piece of the puzzle. Gas is going to play a central role in the U.S. grid for the coming decades. The U.S. is a leading exporter of gas, and that's driving down global emissions. And so we work on policies not only to reduce the life cycle emissions of the U.S. gas supply chain, but also how do we drive forward and push those technologies and push exports to impact the global emissions footprint.
And innovation, where you love to focus on everything from production to uses. Tell us about where you're particularly excited about innovation.
Yeah, I think there's maybe three technology areas that I'm the most excited about today and talking a lot about it here at CERAWeek this week. Geothermal is one of them, this next generation geothermal technology. So these closed loop systems, deep drilling or super hot technologies as well. I worked in the Nevada delegation when I was in government a little over 10 years ago. Geothermal, 10% of its grid, but those conventional technologies are very different than what's coming out today, and we're really excited about the opportunities there. Fission is another area where I think we're on the verge of a breakthrough in this country. Ground has been broken on multiple new designs, including one here in Texas, X Energy, the high-temperature gas reactor developer, is deploying. And we saw TerraPower, Bill Gates' nuclear company, just get its license from the NRC last week. NG Vernova get a $40 billion investment from Japan to build upwards of 8 to 10 small modular reactors in Tennessee and Alabama. So I think we are on this precipice point with nuclear, and I think we're going to see a new nuclear resurgence in this country.
Yeah, those are certainly... Anything else beyond that, just out of curiosity?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there are, I think that there's some really interesting work being done in the manufacturing sector as well. New ways to produce cement that potentially could cure faster and be more resilient and be made in a lower emission way. I think there's a major opportunity in the fertilizer sector as well. I think the global picture right now also kind of demands that the U.S. make a bigger investment in our ability to produce fertilizer. So there's a lot that's exciting going on.
And when you think about the countries we're aligned with most in this, do we have natural allies here and perhaps natural enemies to a degree?
I can tell you, in Washington, D.C., if there is one issue that is bipartisan, it's competition with China. In the end, I think policymakers from the far ends of the right and the left are all kind of together on how we need to invest in America's supply chains. We need to go on offense globally. ClearPath has published a few things on this, on how China is investing, even here in the Western Hemisphere. We did a report on Brazil recently. That's driving a lot of the decisions and a push on industrial policy, so ways that you can do targeted investments to bring more manufacturing into this country and deploy new technologies. On the ally side, I think there's a lot of opportunities. I just use nuclear for example. We're seeing the U.S. and the French partner on the nuclear fuel supply chain. Orano investing billions of dollars in Tennessee to scale up new nuclear enrichment. The Japanese announcement just last week when the prime minister was in D.C., a $40 billion investment in one of the leading U.S. Small modular reactor designs, GE Vernova's BWRX-300.
Yeah, awesome. A lot going on in that area.
Yes.
You testified before Congress just recently about permitting reform, which I would argue probably is the most critical factor facing all of us going forward, whether it's data center transmission lines, power plants, nuclear plants, whatever. Where do you think we are with permitting reform, and how do we break that?
The current system is broken. Right. In the end, it takes longer to get a federal permit in this country than it takes an 18-year-old to get a college degree, and we've got to turn and fix that. The good news is there is more consensus in the halls of Congress on permit reform than there has been in my 20-year D.C. career, and we think it's the single largest opportunity to get a big bipartisan deal across the finish line. And so it's going to be one of our top focuses over the next couple months, and I'm optimistic that Congress has come together and finds a way to restore some sanity and predictability into the process.
The delicate part of that is achieving that transformation, because we have to, right? It just takes too long. It's impossible. We look at Vogtle 3 and 4 for a perfect example, or anything nuclear. Yet, how do you preserve the landowners' rights being protected? It's such a delicate balance there.
It is a delicate balance. In the end, the communities should have a say in what is built in their communities. But there needs to be limits to when they can object, and ultimately we've got to get to yes or no and on a faster basis, right? And so if someone's not engaged in the process from the early stage, like, you kind of lose a bit of your standing, for example. You shouldn't be able to sue a decision years after a permit's come forward. And we've seen that happen on a regular basis where big transmission projects, big power generation projects, big factory get sued when some quote-unquote dynamic changes years later after a permit is issued. Or even seeing a permit get revoked because of politics. That's something that we've got to ensure that we take out of the system and that every project gets a fair shake.
You're a Washington insider, I would say. We've kind of been at a difficult spot for the last couple of years where House and the Senate pretty well, difficult to push anything through without structural changes there, and probably not going to get better through the midterms and maybe even the next election. How do you see getting meaningful change to things that need to be changed, permitting reform, electrical modernization, all a whole host of things? How do you see moving that through a Congress that's fractured and sadly probably short term will become more fractured?
No doubt Congress is more polarized than I've probably ever seen it in my 20 years in D.C. And on energy policy, there is a chunky middle. There's a 60 to 70% of policymakers who want to do what's right for the environment, want to do what's about right for the economy, and want to grow jobs, and they want to further U.S. American competitiveness. And so I think you're going to see this kind of chunky middle, a group of members and United States senators come to a big deal on things like permit reform, because we can't delay. We can't let our partisan differences get in the way of U.S. competitiveness. And if we don't act soon, we're going to lose to China in a wide variety of important areas like AI, like in key manufacturing areas. And so I think that's going to ultimately drive policymakers together.
Let's talk about China for a moment, particularly for batteries. You know, I was reading some stuff here from the chairman of CATL, and he was saying, however you slice it, battery technology will come through China.
Right.
Do you believe that we're so far past that that's a true statement, or do you think we make some changes there?
I think we have to make some changes. We've got to reduce our reliance on China. That's not going to happen overnight. It certainly is going to be a long road. But I think it's one of the areas you've seen the Trump administration get the most aggressive is in the minerals, critical minerals, mining, ultimately battery manufacturing.
You believe we can mine again in this country?
Absolutely. Yeah. We have have to. And we need to work with some of our key partners globally, because in the end, we do have limitations on what's below our feet. And so we should produce here. We should find the partnerships to ensure that we can process and ultimately get the final product that we need for the U.S. economy. And we should maximize those resources. We need to invest more in R&D and recycling and things like along those lines too.
Going back to allies, natural or evolving, is Canada an ally?
Absolutely. I'll use a great example on the nuclear side. I mean, we get significant amount of uranium for our nuclear fuel in the U.S. from Canada. I was referencing that BWRX-300G small modular reactor. The very first one is being built in Canada, and then the next 9 or 10 are going to be built here in the United States. And so I think that partnership is going to be critical in a wide variety of technology areas. I think it's critical in gas, too.
You mentioned Brazil. Brazil an ally?
It can be and it should be. I think the U.S. needs to be really proactive, particularly in our hemisphere, across technologies, across the agriculture sector as well.
India?
It absolutely should be allies with India as well.
Should be, but it's situational, isn't it, with India? Yeah, interesting.
And it's,
for me, as I kind of see, you know, the events in the Middle East and think about not only their short-term impacts but the long-term impacts, it does look like there's a world order beginning to form that's clearly, oddly enough, would be the U.S., Japan, South Korea, clearly, France, and lots of Europe coming towards our way. Venezuela, perhaps, quickly shifting. But some countries are on the fringe. India, Brazil, I would argue.
India is a massive economic market and opportunity for U.S. business, right? Particularly in the energy sector. Fast-growing country, needs more resources to provide the basic needs for their people. And so there's some big opportunities that the U.S. government's doing on nuclear, on carbon capture, for example, on reducing emissions from coal, as coal will likely be a big piece of India's work, and on solar as well, as they try to scale up those technologies.
You talked a little bit about kind of the excitement ahead of you right now would be geothermal, which I tend to believe it can rival nuclear power in terms of outputs. Today, nuclear is caught 20% of the grid. Kind of think geothermal could be 20%. Nuclear should be 40% eventually. Anything that you think we should diminish that should let you? You just mentioned coal.
Yep.
You see coal being increasing or decreasing?
We think there needs to be an all of the above approach.
Even if all of the above might not be environmentally clean?
I think we need to invest in the technologies to reduce the emissions. So I think there are big opportunities to do carbon capture with coal, if coal is going to play a larger piece in the U.S. economy. And then unequivocally, coal is going to play a big part of global energy markets for decades to come. And so I think that's why carbon capture is such a big opportunity for the United States. And it's one of the areas where you've seen Congress come together. One of the tax credits, the 45Q tax credit, has been changed 3 different times in a bipartisan way to enhance and push forward. You saw Congress come together and put billions of dollars behind investments and demonstrations of technologies. Our team, just this week while we were here in Houston, went out to Calpine to see one of their leading carbon capture projects that are in development in Baytown. So we're really excited about that. It's not about the fuel source. It's about dealing with the emissions and finding a way to do that affordably. We can leverage things like gas and coal, which are emitting resources, if we invest in carbon capture, if we invest in methane mitigation, for example, across the gas supply chain. And those resources are going to play a big piece of our energy future for years to come.
Let me just pick on my own industry for a little bit. I find the natural gas industry particularly clearly a part of the solution for the next, I don't know, 5 to 10 years. Abundance natural gas, more to be found. And they don't talk a lot about their own ability to control methane emissions, unplanned releases. You feel like natural gas is clearly a part of the story for the decade or two ahead?
I think natural gas is absolutely a part of the story for decades to come here in the U.S. It's already playing a central role in our power sector. I think there is no way that we can meet this rising demand moment without investing in more gas capacity. And so that's why you're seeing billions of dollars being invested more in the turbine development and power sector projects and in production.
How do you then counteract, like, the Union of Concerned Scientists? I'll just pick on them for a second. But I would say President Biden's DOE consumed by, just could not get over the impact of methane releases. How do you solve that problem?
Yeah, I think there are a lot of common sense, market-driven solutions, alternatives to, for example, the methane tax that the Biden administration had proposed that could invest in the gas supply chain, both upstream, midstream, and downstream, methane detection, methane monitoring, and investing in modernizing our infrastructure as a whole that we can reduce the life cycle emissions of the gas supply chain and improve its carbon footprint.
As I travel and listen and speak, 4 years ago it was all about how clean is it. Today it's a little bit more about how affordable is it. Do you think that pendulum swings back towards maybe the energy trilemma that we tend to talk about, which is affordable, clean, and then abundant?
Yeah, I think we saw over a suite of years the pendulum swing too far to one part of that trilemma, right? And I think we are back in a realm where we have to balance all three of those things. And that's where ClearPath really focuses its energies. How do we drive down the cost of clean energy solutions so that the market can take it and it can scale quickly, right? And so we've got to balance clean, affordable, and reliable as we try to drive our country forward. And we think that doesn't have to be we don't have to have a trade-off. We can make smart investments and ensure all three of those key attributes for the American consumer.
Let's go back one more time to permitting reform, because I tend to agree. I told you I came to Texas from Maine, and as I'm sitting there speaking to energy people in Maine, knowing full well we're so short infrastructure there, mm-hmm. of all types, right? Knowing they need more natural gas pipelines, they need more terminals, they need more everything, they need more wires. Do you think that there is a world in which our governments, state, local, federal, could ever really get to a point where we allow pipelines to be built again to create that investment climate where investors are willing to invest into 10-year horizon, multi-billion dollar projects? Can you see that we break through this logjam?
We don't have an alternative. Yeah. We need every resource at our hands to meet this moment. And so I think that's going to be an essential piece of a permit deal that does get done this year. I think you're going to see it clear the way to build out more transmission lines and find ways to deal with some of the struggles and frictions we have with our federalist system on that. I think we're going to see significant reforms on the pipeline side, Clean Out Water Act reforms. We've seen Democratic governors, particularly in the Northeast, weaponize that process to block pipelines. I think you're going to see folks scale that back. And that's important for all kinds of different infrastructure. It's not just pipelines. It's also for transmission and other
energy
products.
Right. It's about all that infrastructure that energy needs.
Absolutely.
Because no matter which way you go, whether you go underground or I love to talk about the 3D energy grid, above ground, below ground, and the trucks and rails that are in the middle. But it just looks like we are woefully behind in being able to even create the climate that supports the investment, much less the practicality of getting permits, digging, building towers. It's just woefully behind.
Time is money. We need more predictability in this system, and that is going to be critical.
So you're more hopeful than I am that the need for that will overcome the bananas' ability to just clog it up. Yep. For those listening, bananas build absolutely nothing anywhere. You keep going. But you feel like that the need will eventually drive it.
I do. I'm from the Midwest originally, and I think PJM, you're seeing this very clearly. There is a desperate need for more investments into the system to put more electrons on the grid. And as I talk to policymakers across the country back in D.C., they see the gravity of this moment and the need for bold action. And that makes me much more optimistic about getting a big deal like permit reform done in the next 6 months.
Jeremy, I told you we could talk for 2 hours, and I think we might offline, but we'll get to this. We'd love to hand you a magic wand and ask you to use that wand one time for one thing in the next year that you think would have the most impact. How would you use it?
It would be a dramatic shakeup of the federal permitting system here in the United States. We have to modernize it with new technology. I would wave the magic wand and make every single agency across government in charge of permits uptick a new technology, use AI, use the same language so that agencies can communicate together. And then that congressional deal that gives us clear timelines, puts limits on objections for projects so that we can get to yes or no in a faster way. That, I think, would be the single largest thing that we could do to bolster America's lower emission and economic growth over the next decade.
Yeah. I want to highlight what you said. What you said is clearly a great use of it. You want to change the technology first, so when someone files a report, it doesn't just sit on someone's desk, not being manually reviewed. Perhaps the reports are manually written, but they were looking at a common application across a variety of platforms, perhaps collaborative in the commenting. It would clearly speed up, if not even greatly improve.
You would be baffled to know that many of the tools that our federal agencies are using today is the same technology we were using in the 80s and 90s. Yeah. Still passing back PDFs that were scanned. I think there's an immense opportunity to use new technology here that will give us significant gains in predictability in the process. Microsoft here at CERAWeek had a demonstration of how their model is working with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and project you can maybe increase a review of license applications by reduce it by 80%, and that's incredible without losing any of the diligence in the review.
Do you feel like the agencies executing the review want that level of innovation, or are they in fact biased to maintain status quo?
I think folks are frustrated, and I want to give this administration kudos. They've made it a central priority of how they are going to modernize government, and I think it's a really unique moment in time that we can shake it up and really position our country for the better in the long run.
I do think also they've given you a highlight into the window of how hard it is to change.
Absolutely.
They're very good about stating the need for change, maybe suggesting the reasons why, but you also see the immediate reactions to status quo, even when status quo was woefully inadequate.
Absolutely. It's been turning the super tankers hard.
It's been interesting.
Yep.
All right. We love to plant a tree in a national forest in honor of your time, your expertise, the conversation today. Is there a place you'd like us to go?
Well, you're very kind. I very much appreciate that. I do have a place, Apache National Forest in eastern Arizona. So when I worked on Capitol Hill, I had overseen the Wallow Fire that occurred there. It was devastating for those communities, and I really saw firsthand the impact that type of had in the community. And so I've got a kind of a special place in my heart for that White Mountains of eastern Arizona.
Well, our producer, Russ Ray, nothing he loves better than going to Arizona to plant trees. So that's that will make him, well, he's an Arizona native and loves it. So it's great. Thank you. Before we go, anything else you want to talk to us about, maybe what you're doing personally, what ClearPath is doing, something that's happened exciting for you here at CERAWeek?
Yeah, I would stay tuned over the next month and a half here. I think you're going to see some incredible private sector action in key technologies like advanced nuclear and geothermal. We're in this incredible moment for this country, and I think we're really going to see things accelerate. I'd urge folks to visit us at clearpath.org. Our team does an incredible job doing a weekly newsletter that's called The Rundown. It highlights what's happening in Washington, D.C. and what's happening in the energy sector on the private side. It's a good every Friday morning, see what's some of the most exciting things happening in innovation. And I would really encourage you to look out here in the next two months. Some of the private sector conversations I was having here in Houston make me really optimistic about some big deals that are coming together.
Great. I would agree. Clearpath.org, right?
Exactly.
That's where you go to find more. Jeremy, thank you so much for being with us, and thank you for being on Path to Zero.
Yeah, thank you for having me, and thanks for your leadership in this sector.